I suppose the talk is largely based on three quotes, so in terms of like some sort of stakes in the ground. Noel Castry, and again, my sort of background is human geography, which has always been a very promiscuous subject. It kind of borrows and lends and things from a variety of disciplines. But it's really kind of, and what was really nice about some of the talks this morning, about challenging that imaginary. You know, what are some of the new possibilities that emerge if we kind of are encouraged to think differently? So what's the evidence that supports this notion that we live in this commodified world? And if we try and escape from it, again, there were some really interesting conversations around lunch, how do we begin to configure and imagine these kind of alternative futures, this kind of notion about a post-neoliberal or post-capital future? Happily, I'd like to argue, there's a, particularly from the point of view of critique of sort of anarchism, you know, if it's seen as a desirable outcome, it's a utopian dream, it's not possible, it's not realistic, etc. And it's the same sort of fear factor that perhaps is played out within this call to think differently about neoliberalism and our futures. But happily, I would like to argue that we can see these utopian sort of futures based on sort of social justice and empowerment in our kind of everyday spaces and everyday lives. So that being the case, how can we begin to kind of harness, make more visible and value these kind of everyday forms of engagement and work and organisation? So just to, in case I need to argue, what are the kind of dominant figures? Again, it's usually the white bearded male. So this example, we've obviously got David Harvey there. It's quite interesting. Harvey talks about nooks and crannies where capitalism's monetary relations have penetrated. With the Oxford connection, we could have had Nigel Thrift there as well. This paper of his talks about these nooks and crannies. So it's almost like it's that kind of end of history, you know, we don't need to go there anymore. It's how we kind of move forward. Let's not debate this. Let's move on. And Stephen Duncombe, again, he talks about this this kind of fear factor. So, you know, it really kind of captures that Tina, there is no alternative. It closes down the spaces to imagine, to think and act differently, which again is a very powerful kind of recourse. And it's something that I would like to think as critical kind of scholar academics would question. The work of J.K. Gibbs and Graham, they talk about this capitalist-centric worldview. So again, every form of kind of organisation in reference to the economic is, it privileges capitalism. That's the central point. And everything else is its kind of negative kind of opposite in a way. So a lot of the work around the alternative and diverse economies that's emerged in human geography and other critical disciplines for probably around the last sort of 15 or 20 years, it's been with the view of challenging this notion about this kind of capitalist realism. So again, you know, it really does lead me to kind of emphasise that it's not just challenging the things, the tangible things that you see out there. Again, it's this imaginary. And so in many ways, the paper is a call to unleash our economic imaginations. In terms of trying to capture the diverse economies, again, there's publications, academic stuff, sort of diagrams and maps and so on and so forth. Well, geographers love maps. But this was the iceberg model. And it was this kind of pedagogic device. And Gibson Graham, they got a room probably similar to this, and try to just ask the question, what different forms of organisation do we have in our everyday lives? Some of which would obviously be in terms of paid wage labour, producer markets, and this kind of capitalist sort of formal economy. But there were so many other alternative sort of forms of exchange that were very much rehearsed, engaged, and represented within these kind of everyday experiences. So they talked about this notion about the alternative market, alternative pay, sort of forms of labour, non-market, unpaid, non-capitalist, and so on. So in many ways, this challenges the centrality of capitalism by sort of decentering it, saying, look, this is one form of mode of organising the production, exchange and consumption of goods, but it's certainly not the only one. And when we're encouraged to embrace this much broader or thicker reading of the economic, what kind of new possibilities emerge hence? One way of trying to understand this was kind of an earlier form of looking at the relationship between the different typologies in terms of community self-help. So community self-help, crudely, it's those goods and services which are not formally produced by the market and the state. So that's been my sort of dominant area of interest. And again, from a spatial point of view, it's been very much focused on the household and focused on relations within kind of local communities. How can we begin to sort of envisage this in terms of tasks? I don't know, window cleaning, for example. Obviously, if we have the ladders, we're not too scared of heights, etc., we can sort of self-provision. You know, that's the work that takes place within the household, using the unpaid labour of the householders themselves. We look over the fence, we see our next-door neighbour, possibly elderly, possibly our windows are in need of cleaning, so we offer to do that on this kind of mutual aid basis, you know, helping a neighbour. We might, you know, Steve and Mark and Simon down the street might say, oh, these are wonderful, you've got the best windows in the street, can you come and do mine? So there's an aspect of sort of volunteering that, again, is unpaid for all intents and purposes. But then, you know, I might think, oh, I could make a bit of money out of this. So that kind of cash in hand. So cash in hand differentiates from kind of illegal employment insofar as it's legal, but it's not declared for tax purposes. But then eventually I might say, well, I could formalise this window cleaning into a recognised sort of business. So again, it's not the tasks themselves, it's the mode in which they're kind of organised, which would differentiate between these different typologies of exchange. When it comes to the evidence base as well, if we live in this kind of capitalist, commodified world, where do we kind of, you know, draw on this empirical evidence? And in many respects, it's been absent. Again, it's just been assumed that that great weight and body of evidence would exist. But it hasn't. And two forms which have been very common in trying to gain a sort of a pervasiveness, a value, a visibility, has been the time use survey. So again, trying to use time as a proxy to say, well, how, you know, sort of time use value in a way, rather than a financial value, how much time do people spend engaged in different activities. I'll say a little bit about that. And in terms of trying to get a payment, so the argument is if we lived in a commodified world, the vast majority of goods and services would be exchanged in that sort of formal typology of labour. What we really find is over time there are certain countries that are going through an informalisation process, so more work is sourced outside of the market. Again, we can think about DIY shows and gardening shows, you know, all of this thing about, you know, people doing things for themselves and so on. But if you put an estimate there, and this was from the time you survey, I think sort of early 2000, 2002 to 2003, and they said, okay, all of that work that takes place on a domestic kind of basis, if you put a financial number against this, how much would it be worth to the formal economy? How much would that cost? Has anybody got an idea in mind then? It's like the Bruce Forsyth moment, sort of going higher or lower. Just picture it in your mind. And the answer was, this was BBC News, so obviously authority law wisdom, so but 700 billion, if you were to formalise that form of labour, that's how much it would be worth to the economy. The ICV, again, there's no, I mean, the gender sort of division of labour here is something that's extremely important in terms of agitating for the recognition of the value of unpaid work, just on a domestic basis. But ITV competition, imagine having someone do your housework and cleaning for 2 years, !! So again, how much would that sort of cost? The hotel stopped in last night, I noticed that a sort of an ironing service, and it would cost me, I think it was like £2.50 to iron a handkerchief. So if that was the going rate, I dare say that estimate would be much higher. Anyway, what I really want to focus on today is household work practice survey. So this was something that I was directly involved with. I would be everyone's worst nightmare. I'd knock on the door, this kind of cold off door knocking, and say, can you just spare a few minutes? And perhaps an hour later, I'll still be there asking these questions about the type of work and how it was undertaken. What was the labour used? Was it paid? Was it unpaid? What's interesting about this, and again, geography can be anything as long as you put geography in the title, as it were. We've got affluent, so we can compare and contrast affluent sort of neighbourhoods and communities from compared to lower income. We've got that rural and kind of urban distinctions as well. So individually, it's some really interesting findings, and sort of collectively, again, things come together in quite unexpected ways, maybe. But when you start thinking, because again, there was a big sort of task list that we went through, because when you were sort of asking what jobs you get done in the home, on that kind of, that giving people time to reflect or think, there's not many that immediately spring to mind. But when you start looking at the sheer variety and array of jobs that take place, so you've got the obvious ones in sort of caring for children, you know, younger sort of, children, babies, looking after the property, looking after the dog or cat or your plants when you go away on holiday or something, it gets to awesome. Things about routine housework, so again, you know, washing, cooking, cleaning. It's quite interesting, the ironing example is people's number one worst form of kind of like household sort of activity. So you've got things like DIY, the gardening we've mentioned, but again, property maintenance, property improvement. So all of these tasks, you know, we sort of investigated, and then we kind of reversed it and said, okay, do you do any work for like neighbours or other people, and again, under what basis? So there was probably a cup of tea and a few biscuits that we had for doing that. It might be clear on the handout, but this kind of trying to extend and deepen the analysis of kind of Gibson Graham from the iceberg model. Again, there are many different types of kind of organisation that we can see taking place. I mean, in the paper, I sort of say, look, it's important to kind of preserve these spaces, and how do we do that? Well, I quite like looking at this from an anarchist sort of squint, as it were. So looking at things like, you know, self-organisation, mutual aid, reciprocity, cooperation, collaboration, and so on. However, and I'll come to this when it comes to harnessing, we've got to be very kind of cautious about making some absolute distinctions here. So it's kind of a fast and loose distinction between different topologies, but again, the hatch line suggests that there's some overlap and fluidity within and between these different forms. Type of labour, I mean, again, this is just to kind of flag up the relations in terms of absolute figures. So this was a collective sort of summary. And what you see is when it came to all of the jobs that were completed, it was still the household that was very much at the forefront of this. You know, 76% in kind of deprived localities would complete these tasks in within the household, 72% in affluent urban regions, and so on. You know, externalising that and sourcing jobs from a formal kind of private sector was significant in certain ones, but it tended to be the more specialised jobs and so on. But again, there's some interesting ways we can begin to look at that. One of them is the argument that if the household was richer, they'd externalise more forms of this source of labour, but it's not as simple as that. So again, we've got economic and non-economic rationale. Sometimes it's easier to do the job. I prefer to do it myself. You know, this notion about getting some satisfaction from DIY activities or gardening, whatever, and so on. And it could be a pleasurable activity in certain circumstances. It's quite interesting with children as well, and the use of children as in terms of trying to make them see the value of working hard, or maybe to gain some extra pocket money. Again, those kind of capitalist sort of rationales about self-interest and profit motive, you know, householders are horrified if you suggest, well, you got your child to do that as a cheap source of labour, you know, no other sort of nexus in between. So far then, we've just sort of looked very whirlwind account of the way in which we're trying to gain a space, significant space, for some of these kind of alternative non-captain's work practices. And again, you know, another white-bearded male, Peter Kropotkin. What's really interesting is, you know, this is from 1880, but it could easily be perhaps relevant to our own times. He talks about the destruction of these kind of mutual aid, collaborative forms of support, and so on. This need for a new life becomes apparent. So just to kind of throw out some thoughts, because again, the ideal is to encourage experimentation, differentiation, and so on across time and space that where it's important and relevant. I think we can argue that this notion about this kind of post-capitalist, post-neoliberal world isn't some utopian space out there. It's very much embedded in some of these everyday forms of organisation that we can identify with and we can see in a very visible, literal sense. If you want to kind of harness this in the future vision, you could say, well, it's complementary to the state and the market, particularly at a time of crisis, maybe. Or indeed, you know, what's the possibilities in terms of offering a real kind of alternative? And so again, we ask the question and hopefully, you know, generate some interesting debates around that. However, this slide was probably included based on some quite well-intentioned criticism about looking at this kind of romanticised view of the household and alternative practice and so on. That we do have some critical challenges. Again, geography is interested in scale. It's okay talking about these in these sort of immediate spaces, the household, the local community. Again, that notion about face-to-face engagement is particularly important. There's some wonderful research about the solidarity economy in New York and, you know, bartering as a form of exchange and how wonderful and life-affirming and so on it is, an alternative relationship with people. But what happens when you increase that kind of scale? So Peter North, geographer at the University of Liverpool, he talks about this kind of 10 square miles of this beautiful kind of like engaging and interactive collaborative spaces. The further you go out, again, how is that impacting at this kind of broader scales? Also, what do we mean by the alternative? Again, everything can be sort of alternative in many ways. What's that kind of essence of that? What is it that we really mean in terms of offering a unique kind of direction or vision forward, beyond, outside, so on, capitalism? You know, we must avoid that danger of romanticising. Again, is it complementary, the alternative? Is it framed in that kind of relationship, or is it counter-gemonic? Is it practical? And again, this is speaking to so many of the papers earlier this morning. What is desirable? What can we achieve sort of in the here and now? There's always that darker side and notion of a kind of a lack of choice, because you've fallen through the various safety structures or forms of positive kind of identities and affinities within formal kind of work, and you're left with no other choice. This is something that you just, you know, it's that sort of survival, I suppose, mentality. Stephen Hodgkinson, just to illustrate the point, because again, we can talk about the abstract, what would it potentially mean in practice? You know, he talks about housing. You know, obviously kind of self-help as this kind of alternative substitute for a formal kind of market provision of housing. Squatting, again, it's alternative, it's oppositional, but how successful, how kind of practical is that? Particularly within, you know, drawing on the UK. But all other forms as well. You know, we could have schooling in there, you know, schooling, education, and so on. So let's be aware about when we talk about the alternative, again, how, what does that mean? And if we promote it, is it towards these empowered sort of spaces of social justice, environmental sustainability, and so on? Or is it somehow working, particularly at a time of resilience, to kind of neoliberal ends? Is it inevitable? You know, this is really a really important question. Unfortunately, the Household Work Practices Survey, so they're kind of ongoing to a point, and in fact looking at post-Soviet kind of countries as well, that kind of trajectory. At a time of austerity, it would be really important and interesting to work out the implications for coping strategies, again at a time of kind of austerity measures. But there are barriers, social and otherwise, that we have identified, and how can we possibly begin to address these, and again, not to isolate them, but to look at them fixed in particular spaces. Yeah, the danger of not romanticising the kind of household. There was a notion with that kind of feminisation of the workforce that there would be a redistribution or a renegotiation of labour on the domestic front. That's not happened to all intents and purposes. So again, when we talk about the household, I mean, ideally it could be a space of empowerment and et cetera, but obviously it's a space of archy as well, particularly patriarchy, lack of choice, gender divisions. We've got to be very much aware of them. And indeed this notion of the triple burden, so women are more likely to be at the forefront of various kind of community exchanges, you know, self-help and so on. However, yes, we mustn't essentialise or romanticise sort of work that takes place. There are some things that are incredibly empowering, maybe, and there are some things that, again, it's a more sort of menial tasks. Colin Ward, it's all about the forms of kind of organisation, I suppose. And if you choose to do something and the circumstances are desirable, and again, it's that giving something of yourself and seeing that flourish through the work you undertake, then work, you know, can be incredibly empowering and positive and so on. For some people looking at gardening, it might be the opposite. It might be the most horrible thing to have to engage, you know, occasionally like mowing the lawn or so on. But I don't know if you've undertaken this exercise. If you go onto Google and type in, you know, work makes me, and then it does that autofill. Can you kind of guess what connections are made?
Bored.
Sad. Bored, sad. It's the audience participation bit, this one. So bored and sad.
Ill.
Miserable, nervous, crying, stressed, suicidal.
Well, it's not changed a lot since I did it.
That's cheating.
So yeah. Well, the nice thing is I did this first, you know, about a year ago, so it's obviously not changed in any kind of way from that. So depressed, suicidal, nervous, feel sick, tired, happy.
But isn't that... Doesn't Google personalise your search?
I was saying things about my employer. Those wonderful students.
They're not that smart.
So again, it's always been sort of critical. So there's just to kind of summarise and so on. You know, this is supposed to be, despite that last slide, you know, it's quite empowering. It's supposed to give us more opportunities to think quite creatively in terms of that reference point of ourselves and the way which we relate within these familiar spaces, the household, local communities and so on. But again, more broadly, there's at a time of crisis, and again, it's kind of captured some of the debates at lunch, you know, for crisis is also an opportunity. It might be an opportunity to write lots of papers and get research if you put neoliberal in the title. How do we break that sort of dominant orthodoxy? But again, it's not appealing to the past and asking the same questions and trying to come up with the same solutions and answers, but doing something new and again, experimenting, prefigurative practice and so on. Yeah, so again, Frankie Howard, that's not often sort of put in there. But no, I think, you know, this notion about another world, this and kind of revolution, you know, it's, you know, working class revolution and so on. It's not about waiting for that perfect moment or that perfect storm. It's just not going to happen. I think to, well, without a complete kind of collapse of various life support systems and again, economic, environmental, social crisis, how they kind of come together, quite possibly envisaging the end of the world as we know it. But saying that this is desirable, you know, it should be a choice, it should be something that we can work on, and again, you know, doing that on an everyday sort of basis where possible. So the final image then, because I think a lot of the commonalities between the papers is about this notion about kind of freedom and social justice and empowerment and so on. And so the notion that a free society cannot be achieved by the simple act of swapping the old for the new, but again, it's about building and extending these spheres of freedom wherever and wherever possible. Thank you very much. Thank you.